I think a good message is it's attuned, I think, you know, to its audience. It's grounded in understanding of what its audience cares about, where they're coming from, the kind of language and the way they like to speak and how they like to be heard, but also how like they like to be spoken to.
Welcome to Communicating Purpose. I'm John Higginson, and I believe that the best way to land a message is by talking about something you honestly and passionately believe in. And by doing so, you bring people with you. Your passion becomes theirs, and that is the power of purpose-led communications. Now, today I'm joined by Paul David, co-founder and CEO of Literal Humans. Literal Humans is a creative marketing agency that helps mission-focused brands tell their stories. Paul is an experienced communicator and writer, having worked with a range of startups and purpose-led brands, including Content Stack, Submittable, and TransferWise. Previously, Paul was an English teacher in Philadelphia, as well as helping to design two schools in Brooklyn and Queens. Paul speaks passionately about diversity and has attracted a highly diverse team of staff in London. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks for having me on the pod, John.
So just tell me a bit about that journey to becoming the purpose-led communicator that you are today.
Yeah, it started in a classroom in Southwest Philly. I went through the Teach for America program fresh out of uni. It was an exciting time to be a teacher. It was in the midst of the Obama campaign as he was becoming president. So that was those halcyon days, as they say. That sort of led to a career in education and various, teaching capacities, taught at university and like a sort of taught with Robert Reich, who was the former Secretary of Labor, was one of his teaching assistants in the Powerful Wealth and Poverty class, taught in a prison when I was living in California at San Quentin. Wow. And ran a couple of organizations that were focused on youth and criminal justice reform and education reform as well. And then that kind of led into a career of writing about education, philanthropy specifically, an outfit called InsidePhilanthropy.com. And then that kind of led me into content marketing and agency world.
Great. Well, you've skirted over Obama there. I think you've got a more interesting story there. Go on, tell us about your experience there working with Obama.
Yeah, my senior year of university, I was lucky enough to get an internship in then Senator Obama's office. And it was my first day was the day that he announced he was running for president. So January 16th, 2007, if I'm not mistaken, was the day that he put up the video about his exploratory committee and had to walk over the press to get into, to the point of PR, walk over the press to get into his office. And it was a powerful moment, and things got a lot more serious with that internship after that. So I had to make a decision at some point. Do I want to work in the campaign, go to the White House? And I made the alternative decision to go teach kids in the inner city in Southwest Philly. And I don't know if a lot of people would make that decision, but I'm proud of it. And it was values aligned for me. So
yeah, well that must have been one of the luckiest breaks for an intern to suddenly on their first day of their internship to be told that the person that they're going to work for is about to run for president of the United States and a winning one at that, and the first black president, and all those great things. Now, I think that kind of leap from education to communications is not as common a one, I think, as it maybe should be. I think, you know, communications is really, in many ways, education, isn't it? The best communication is educating people, but far more communicators, PR, come from my kind of background, i.e. former journalists. It's a very well-trodden path, but not as many come from education. So just tell us about that bit. Why did you, how and why did you come from education into communications?
Yeah, I mean, the how was starting to, I've always been a writer. I've always been, you know, a reader, avid reader. And so starting as an English teacher, a history teacher, and then kind of turning that into a writing career where I was writing about education and stories about, you know, how education was being funded and supported in the US, that got me excited and kind of grounded in the stories of the young people and the families that were being impacted by the way that money was moving, particularly in the education system in the US. There's a lot of private money in that system. And then, yeah, more for me personally, I think it just made sense. And I'm constantly astounded by how I can apply the skills I learned in the classroom and the education space to marketing and sales and growth strategy. There's a great book out by Daniel H. Pink, called To Sell Is Human. And he talks a lot about non-sales selling and how people in the eds and meds profession, as he calls them, are constantly selling, even though they don't think of themselves as salespeople. Mm-hmm. They're convincing people to improve their lives through medicine or through learning and growth. And that has, you know, major applications to marketing, PR, growth strategy. Yeah. We're trying to push and move audiences to take certain actions and to, you know, buy products that are going to improve their lives, hopefully. So lots of overlap there.
Yeah. Well, as you say, we're all selling to some degree, aren't we? And you know, I think selling along with kind of PR gets a bad name because you think of the worst of it. So, same with lobbying as well. It gets this kind of bad rep because sometimes something gets a reputation based on the worst kind of kinds of it. But actually, as you point out there, we all need to sell our ideas. We all need to convince people of our merit. We all need to convince people that the thing we're doing is worthwhile, even if you're not selling product. Even if you're in a charity, you have to constantly be convincing donors that their money is being well spent. So I think that's a really good point there. In terms of purpose, what does...
Yeah, you've got Obama to blame for a little bit of the bad reputation on lobbying. He had a lot of things to say about lobbying when he was running. So, but that, that was in vogue at the time. Like he was, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly not just him. Absolutely, there should be a check on some of that lobbying that's going on behind closed doors. It's not something that we're advocates of at all. We like lobbying out in the public and lobbying for a lot of the things that we believe are good. You know, all those things on the environment and change, and some of those changes, they all take lobbying. And so it's just worth recognizing that lots of those charities, they're all lobbying, and they're all trying to change the world for the better. Just tell us a bit more about where your purpose lies.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been passionate about, obviously, you know, education and you know, that we work with a lot of education outfits, many of whom are based in the States. One of them, for example, is they're called Core Learning. They've just merged with another outfit called Unbound Ed. But they're one of the leading providers of literacy and numeracy support services to, under-resourced school districts in the U.S. So we just walked through an entire, you know, rebrand and website redesign with them. So even though I'm no longer in the classroom or, you know, working on the ground with young people, I love the fact that I get up, you know, I get to get up every day and work for amazing organizations that are doing that work and to help them tell their stories, you know, in more convincing and powerful fashion, and to still have that connection to the work. But I feel like I've always been kind of like an activist and an advocate. It's in my DNA. You know, I'm a biracial, you know, mixed race kid from the States. I grew up with queer parents. You know, I had two dads before it was cool, like in Modern Family and things like that. I have family members who've struggled with substance abuse. My mother was actually pregnant with me while she was in prison. She's struggled with heroin addiction her entire life. And you know, all those things, just, you know, I grew up with a dyslexic dad. One of my adoptive fathers was dyslexic and somehow I became an English teacher. So it's all baked in there and it all sort of like supercharged me to get into education, activism and what I'm doing now.
Yeah. And there's a lot of different types of diversity that you've got in there. You're talking about two of the main ones that people think of: racial diversity, as well as sexual diversity and mental difference as well. Neurodiversity. Thank you. Is that what drives your passion into diversity?
Yeah, I think my family itself is incredibly diverse. The community that I come from, I grew up outside of Philadelphia, a place called Narrowtown, so kind of an old mill town just on the outskirts of the city. Incredibly diverse. I feel like I just benefited wildly from growing up with people from all around the globe. It was the best education I think possible. And I went to some good schools and things like that, but I think that's what fueled it. And it's allowed me to move to a place like London, you know, start an agency in an entirely new country. I did some of that work previously for a previous agency in the US. It's allowed me to travel freely and adapt to different environments. I've lived in Mexico, I lived in Kenya, I've lived in Spain, I've, you know, bounced around. But it's, yeah, that passion for diversity is kind of baked into my family history. I exist because immigrants from, you know, the from Italy, from Ireland, from Africa, you know, made their way, some forced, some of their own free will, to America to have a better life. And in the case of the folks who did it freely and the case of the folks who were forced, they survived. And I wake up every day and I feel blessed, you know, to be alive. And the fact that, you know, I come from such strong stock, that makes me passionate about other cultures and learning and just kind of, yeah, just enjoying the zest of every day. So.
Great. Tell us about a significant moment you've had where you felt that you've had a real breakthrough in communications.
I would say probably looking back to my experience working for the New York City Department of Education. You mentioned, you know, I designed, co-designed with an amazing team, the best job I've had, you know, to date. But we co-designed and launched three schools, two in Queens, one in Brooklyn, that were focused on, changing the outcomes for Black and Brown youth, with the idea being that the system, you know, the largest school district in the country wasn't serving them very well. And that was a huge messaging challenge. We had to sell parents on, you know, competency-based education that moved away from standardized testing, that was, you know, deeply culturally immersive, that would ground the students in their cultural identity, and do different things like, you know, we did African libations in the morning to ancestors who had passed or people in the neighborhood who had been, killed in local violence, really different stuff. And so we had to hit the streets and market that to parents who were worried about test scores and, you know, college acceptances. And we did all that and we do all that, but there's more. It was sort of the messaging angle that we took. And I think my proudest day professionally to this day was probably, you know, the day one of those schools opened and I went and, you know, just saw 80 students standing around an auditorium. And the principal then said, you know, hey, tell Dr. Perry that, you know, something that you did, and why the school is amazing for you. And by the third kid who came up to me, you know, I was in tears because they were just telling me how amazing the school was for them and how different it was than the schools, the substandard schools that their colleagues were going to. So we won that messaging challenge. I'm so grateful for that. And that sort of got me started on this journey.
Wow. Yeah, that's fantastic. Tell me what you think makes a good message.
I think a good message is kind of, and this is another sort of shout out to that book to Sell as Human, but it's, it's attuned, I think, you know, to its audience. It's grounded in understanding of what its audience cares about, where they're coming from, the kind of language and the way they like to speak and how they like to be heard, but also how they like to be spoken to. I think a good message is, I'm a big believer in brevity, you know, like I think being quick and brief and economizing and saving people's time is really important, especially these days when we're just awash in so much information. There's a piece about, it is valuable, like it adds value. You know, maybe it's something that person hasn't thought of. Maybe it's something that, helps them go about their day better, helps them understand the world better. So the messenger has to have done that work to sort of synthesize information. And we're always thinking about that in content marketing. How are we just not piling into the mass that is the internet, but we're actually adding value. So I think those are some of the key bits.
Yeah. Absolutely. I totally agree with that. And especially the more we're living in a world where people feel that they have less time, that they're being bombarded with just infinite messages. And I think over the next few years, it will be the way that you're able to curate messages and provide really strong messages will be what people are looking for. There's been this, I think over the last 10 years, there's been a real kind of, let's get as much information as we possibly can. And then that's going to start pushing back. The people that are, that want their own headspace are going to be saying, no, I'm going to block out all of this noise and I'm going to find the people that are great at curating and filtering the right messages for me that aren't just the right messages in terms of some of what we've got at the moment, which is echo chamber. It's not about echo chamber. And at Higginson, we do a lot of work on making sure that people hear messages and things that they don't necessarily agree with. I think that's so important that you listen to things you don't necessarily agree with rather than just looking for those that you do. But I think the important thing will be the quality of analysis, the quality of things that you hear.
I agree that I'm just going to tag onto that just to say that, like, I was listening to a book today on Blinkist, a kind of a book summary, and talking about AI and the impact of kind of the flood of information and how that will sort of continue to advance these echo chambers, you know, and this sort of like tunnel vision that we already see in social media, but how, you know, the importance of listening to contrary opinions, it builds your sort of emotional resistance and your mental toughness, and not to just stick to your position, but to be open to new ideas. So I agree with you. I think that curation will be the like sort of next phase of, you know, the apps that are going to get it right, the technology is going to get it right. It'll be sort of like, you know, maybe similar to parts of the TikTok algorithm where it introduces you to new things selectively, but also keeps you entertained with stuff that you really like. And so really nailing that balance, I think will be key in helping people sift through the masses of information. I think will be, those are going to be some of the super apps of the future, arguably, like Pocket, I think, is maybe a good example, but that's just folks saving stuff. But like, how does it organize and synthesize? So
exactly. Tell us about one of your biggest communications failures, if you can.
Oh, man, got a good one for you. So at some point when I was in grad school, I was training to be a principal, a school leader. And I was working at the school in Boston, in the southern bit of Boston, a place called Dorchester. And I had this incredible mentor, Mary Skipper. She's actually the superintendent of the Boston Public Schools right now. And she's just one of these like dynamo, principals at the time. She had taken the worst performing middle school and the worst performing high school in Boston and combined them and turned it into a high performing school, which was, you know, incredible feat of leadership. And somehow I got to be, I just keep finding myself in these positions, John, with like Obama and like this Mary Skipper. And it's just, I don't know, I keep getting lucky with mentors. So, but yeah, I was her mentee. Yeah. And at some point she left because she was, sorry for the noise here. She essentially got promoted and I was put in charge of the middle school for a period of time. And what happened during that time was essentially, I had to plan the standardized testing for the entire school and I screwed up. And, you know, I got the schedule wrong and people were sent to the wrong rooms. And so basically I had hundreds of teachers and students crowding in the hallway, looking for the right room and looking to me to kind of fix it. And it was an absolute mess. And literally just hundreds of students just staring me down, being like, where am I going? Oh, teachers yelling at me, screaming at me. I think a teacher cussed at me. So it was definitely the most memorable communication breakdown in my career.
Oh, boy. Okay. That sounds absolutely awful. It's putting hairs up on my spine to even thinking about that situation, because it's always the one where it's in people, the ones where you're messing up on events and people in the room and all those kind of things. That they're the kind of things that always keep comms professionals up at night. So you've spoken a little bit about Pocket and some of those other things, and just tell us about where you get your news and information from. Anything that you'd recommend at all?
I've been getting a lot of value out of email newsletters that are curated. Refind is one. That's kind of like a curator of curators, I guess. Obviously like the standard, you know, Guardians and New York Times of the world. But I really enjoy newsletters that are sort of tailored and will deliver, Marketing Brew is another one, Morning Brew. Axios, I think, does really good summaries and things like that. So, those are a few places.
Great. And then in terms of getting a message across yourself, what do you find is the most effective medium at the moment?
I've always been a writer, so I just really appreciate writing out my thoughts, and whether it's like a LinkedIn post, a blog post, an op-ed, any sort of editorial piece, I really value that. And I'm really enjoying the medium of podcasting. You were nice enough to come on our show, and I've jumped on here, and I feel like it's such a powerfully intimate medium. You're literally pumping into the brains of people through their ears, and I think you can get a lot across if you package it the right way, and you kind of put some work into structuring the episode, and it fits nicely into people's day, whether they're on a walk or on their commute to work and things like that. So I'm bullish on podcasts as well.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, one of the reasons I left journalism in the end, I was political editor of Metro newspaper. You probably know Metro as the commuter newspaper. It's the most read in the UK. And I remember going into work, and it used to be, when I started there, say 15 years ago, kind of in the mid-noughties, essentially, you would get on the train and every single person would be reading Metro. This was before people were getting their news from the phone. Every single person would be picking it up. And then I was there for 7 years. And as I got towards the end of that and the smartphone started picking up, you just saw less and less people. And now you look on a train, very few people will be reading a physical copy of the newspaper. The majority of people will have earphones on. And I just thought, hold on, those earphones, that is your access to people. And I started podcasting maybe 8 years ago. It was really quite niche then. Almost no one had heard of podcasts. And I just thought, hold on, this would be quite a good medium, because those things in everyone's ear that they're using to block out the noise and everything else, that's the access there. And I certainly use podcasts for, walking around. And it's the one time that I can get in-depth information. And I think in most people's working days, they're slightly guided by the emails. It's quite hard to read an in-depth article. I certainly read in-depth at the weekend. I love getting weekend papers and getting that physical copy and spending the time doing that. But during the week, I definitely find it harder to do so. And podcasts is one of those ones for me where I can kind of listen more deeply into a whole range of subjects. It's not just news. You can just go into a whole load of different areas that you just take an interest in and just feel like you're an expert after a few hours of listening to different things.
Yeah, I agree. I love a long walk around Victoria Park, a podcast, an audiobook. I use Blinkist for like summaries as well. I swim across all the different types of podcasts as well. So yeah.
Great. Are there any Higginson Strategy clients that you've had a look at that you're that you look up to in any way?
I would say, like broadly, the work that you all do in anti-plastics is like really exciting, and I think you've all like found a niche that kind of really works and really is like an important one, and kind of I think it shows that though you play in the space of like PR and politics, like you're not afraid to take a stance and put a flag down. I think a lot of folks in those spaces, they waffle and they flex and they just kind of don't, put their eggs behind a particular campaign. And I think the fact that you all have done that across multiple clients is really powerful. And I think a lot of folks are afraid, oh my gosh, this is going to cost me work, especially as an agency owner. But actually, it sends a signal that like, we believe in something, we care about something, we're passionate about something. And it sounds like it's been an attractor of good work to you all. So really impressed by that.
Yeah. That's a good message for any business founders out there. Don't be afraid of that niche. It won't mean that those clients that aren't in the niche will all run away. I think that's a really good point you make there, Paul. So Paul David, co-founder and CEO of Little Humans, thank you for joining me, John Higginson, on Communicating Purpose.